This is Mae Brussel, and it is part two of broadcast number 797. One thing that these manipulators don't take into account when they assassinate somebody like John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Watergate, a person like Richard Nixon, get him out of office with Spiro Agnew, or controgate a president like Ronald Reagan and George Bush as vice president, one of the things that they don't figure about and have to meet more opposition later in their actions are the amount of investigators that increase and do research and studies so that it's more difficult to take control of power away from another group and not have raw nerves exposed. That is the trick, to do a surgical operation like a laser operation without cutting the body and showing the blood. But they don't yet have a laser operation for taking over power. So in the process of doing these grabs for power, even though they stay on top and look pretty good, it's pretty likely that someday they themselves will be thoroughly exposed for what they are and how they manipulated us, because in the process of their operations, as I say, more and more raw nerves come out, and writers, investigators, radio people are picking up these pieces and going with them. Now, this book, The Agency, The Rise and Decline of the CIA, is an interesting title because the decline of the CIA is very evident in a case like Contragate, where William Casey is the director of the CIA, and he gives orders with the National Security Council and the Defense Intelligence Agency to not pay any attention to the CIA. We'll use them to shine our shoes. We'll tell them when we want to do something, but they're not included in the plannings. So that the taking of power, the decline of the CIA, began with William Donovan building it up, starting it, and then the decline with William Casey, who took away from his own agency. As a matter of fact, I have a very good long article from, I believe it's the Washington Post, that Ronald Reagan didn't use any of the agencies that he prided himself in building up. Now, this book from Simon & Schuster, interesting publisher, and I'll do more than that in a little bit, takes into account that when the CIA was formed and until Richard Nixon came to power, it had a certain position. It got along with Congress fairly well. There was some congressional oversight by the mid-1970s. After Watergate, there was oversight. But for the first 30 years, they existed well with Congress in an informal way, and the director of the Central Intelligence Agency and his associates seemed to not have too much conflict. John Kennedy fired the head of the CIA, Allen Dulles. He said, there's a secret government behind my back. But even when he had his head blown off, the CIA mingled with the congressional body, and there still wasn't any challenging of their activities. And Congress was at the same low level, the intelligence community, in which they allowed these things to happen. That's why there isn't any conflict. But this book goes into the fact that before there was a church committee and investigation of the CIA, there was Henry Kissinger. And the author says, from the day he entered the Nixon administration as national security advisor, Henry Kissinger asserted the dominance of the National Security Council. And see, that's the extra branch that wasn't provided for in the Constitution, or the German head who was running it, and its expanded staff over the director of Central Intelligence Agency, the NSC, and the CIA in all intelligence matters. The administrative coup d'etat, and he refers to it as a coup d'etat when Kissinger came in, introduced a strong and devastating element of White House politics and prejudices in the intelligence process, and often led to the CIA being excluded from any input into Kissinger-Nixon policy initiatives. With the creation of the Kissinger-Haig Plumbers Unit, the precedent was set for later national security involvement in covert operations that were formerly handled by more trained and experienced CIA personnel, closer to intelligence analysis and more distant from the Oval Office. The Carter and more recently exposed Reagan NSC dabbling in covert operations, particularly in Iran and Nicaragua, is the unfortunate offspring of the Nixon-Kissinger administration shift. And Mr. Ranley reports in this quotation, very early in the Nixon administration, it became clear that the president wanted Henry Kissinger to run intelligence for him and not the CIA, and that the NSC staff in the White House under Kissinger would control the intelligence community. It was the beginning of the shift of power away from the CIA to the new center, to the growing NSC staff. It was a personal shift of power by the president in his own interest, and an institutional shift as well. And the shift of power, of course, here is identical to Fritz Kramer working at the Kriegsakademie on shifting power to Adolf Hitler away from the existing German government and the agreements of the Versailles Treaty. The author goes on and says, from this point, the agency started to lose influence to the NSC staff under the president's special assistant for national security affairs, who in turn has paralleled and at times challenged the director of Central Intelligence Agency as being the president's chief intelligence officer. Of course, the CIA and the NSC were both formed in 1947. The Constitution had no provisions for them. But NSC shifted with Haig and Kissinger, currently enjoying their prominence, one running for president and one traveling with the CIA, the NSC director, Frank Carlucci and David Rockefeller, and promoting their trilateral opinions. This book says, the technique Kissinger used was never to say directly that he and the president wanted to ask for analysis generally, taking out of what was particular interest to them. This was matched by procedural and administrative changes that enhanced the position of the White House and Kissinger, particularly in intelligence matters. And of course, Fritz Kramer wasn't putting Henry Kissinger into a chalet or a home in Germany at Omar Amagai with top Nazi officers, then putting him in Harvard and into the Council of Foreign Relations on the board of Chase Manhattan for nothing. Kissinger was trained and groomed for this job. And the author says, in December 1968, during the transition period, this is after Robert Kennedy is killed a few months earlier and Martin Luther King, both killed in June, during this transition period before Nixon's inauguration, Henry Kissinger had informed the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Richard Helms, that he was no longer to participate in full meetings of the National Security Council. Previously, the director of Central Intelligence Agency gave an intelligence overview briefing leading off every morning, every NSC meeting rather, and was an active participant in that body, which maintained responsibility for intelligence and covert operation requirements for the president, while Richard Helms, with the assistance of Defense Secretary Melvin Laird, managed to reverse the Kissinger dictate that he can't be present, and nevertheless was the beginning of the CIA's great slide into near ruin. And this goes into the NSC started building up its own agency, its own people, to destroy the CIA so that they could do what was referred to as back channeling. And he says that secret operations were never prohibited. Congress seemed to want to know about them, but that was a contradiction in terms. The excuse to not tell them was that there would be a leak. And in the Kissinger, Nixon back channeling, they were not informing officials. They were not informing them about negotiations or the details of policy, and the idea of secrecy and secret agency outside the congressional oversight was something that they created as soon as Richard Nixon came in power. And of course, I said that Richard Nixon was selected by the major aerospace industries, the Hughes Aerospace, the California group, the Lincoln Club, and a group of fascists after World War II. And he was meant to take over after Eisenhower died. He'd been vice president for 8 years and ran a red scare against Helen Douglas and Jerry Voorhees and into Congress, the Senate, and House against Alger Hiss. He was the selected president, and when he lost to John Kennedy in 1960, all that had to be arranged by people directly related to the Contragates today, and I'll be doing a lot of broadcasts on the links of the Contragate agents to the murder of John Kennedy. All they did was to get rid of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and their Nixon was back in power. Henry Kissinger was in power, and Alexander Haig was in power. Several years ago on World Watchers, it was 1984, 3 years ago, I mentioned this secret team built up in Italy and the United States that controls the higher echelons of government and foreign affairs. Ted Rubenstein up in Palo Alto got an article from New Statesman titled Wanted, Men Enjoying Power, a report of the Italian Paramilitary Commission investigating the P2 Masonic Lodge. Now, that was 3 years ago, but this is important because these people link directly to Donald Reagan, to the P2 connections, the pizza connections, and the an indictment just went down this past week on 17 defendants. They were found guilty, but there are direct links of the Secretary of the Treasury, who became the Chief of Staff, to these very people. And what I mentioned 3 years ago was this article that talked about these higher echelons and how the P2 from Italy is connected to every major unsavory aspect of life in Italian Republic, of attempted coups, political assassinations, right-wing terrorism, left-wing terrorism, the mafia, not only in Italy, but in Latin America and in the United States. Their connections are there. One of the common denominators was Licio Gelli, the head of the P2, who attended Jimmy Carter's inauguration, Ronald Reagan's inauguration. And remember, this article referred to that inverse, that upturned pyramid, where at the top there's Licio Gelli and the mysterious world. And if you turn it upside down, there was the upturned pyramid where little is known. And Gelli is probably, this author said, a linchpin between the lower and upper pyramid. Well, what we're getting a view of now in the course of ConcreteGate and the hundreds of articles that are pouring out is a view of both of these pyramids and where they touch and meet, and the operators, including members of the White House team, such as the White House Chief of Staff, his connections to the Vatican, to the Freemasons, to the narcotics traffic, and E.F. Hutton, managed by George Bush's brother-in-law. These characters melt right into these double triangles, one upside down to the other, and touch bases with a lot of raw nerves, or if there's blocks in two pyramids, one upside down and one up touching, each of these little blocks that are carried by a lot of slaves who are then blinded are visible, and the pieces of these pyramids are coming out in all the various newspaper articles that are related to the Iran-Contragate story. One of the kingpins in this was Michele Sindona and his links to the American Mafia. And Sindona was closely tied into John Connally, Secretary of Navy, and to Permandex. And I want to make some of those connections as I go through the people that have been killed by these organizations. And I've talked about them for years. I want to update a lot of that for you, because what you're seeing now is not just a simple organization described as criminals, which this author Donald Sassoon refers to, is not just another mafia. It is the product of a political system which was constructed 40 years ago in 1944, at the end of the war, when this was written, by Italy's Christian Democratic Party. And of course, Alexander Haig is head of NATO and part of P2, and Henry Kissinger and Michael Ledeen melt right into the American-Italian team locking of a system of controlling the world, and use various organizations for that purpose. And in the process, a lot of people are expendable. They are used up and old, such as Ronald Reagan, and they can be kicked out, or Richard Nixon. Their power for all purposes is gone, but the framework stays on, and the framework are those people meeting the trilateral in San Francisco this past week. As I say, when you get this, the meeting will have been over, but for us, it's just happening. The newspaper this morning described a new assessment of Admiral Poindexter's work, that he played a central role in the NSC, that the congressional committees find him as a potentially important witness. He has a very keen memory. He keeps a lot of records. And they said the public interest is in the glamorous North, but the emphasis may be in the wrong place. Now, I never thought of Ollie North as glamorous. They build up all this stuff because they had ribbons and Purple Hearts from the war. And that was media hype. His secretary, Fawn Hall, it's media hype. North is media business. Every article is titled, North did this, North did that. And then as time goes on, you find General Secord, a general in the Air Force, and Tom Kleins and Theodore Shackley, the CIA agents, and John Singlaub, a general. And then, as time goes on, articles are pouring out now about their links to the Nguyen Bank, with admirals and generals, and CIA Director William Colby, and intelligence lacings with the head of the Nguyen Hand. It was run by Task Force 157, which was Henry Kissinger again, and Admiral Bobby Inman. And admirals are very important. John Connally was Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, Fred Korth, and the Navy Intelligence and the Defense Intelligence Agencies are the kingpins. So it's taken 4 months for the investigators that were hired and the powers that be to admit that there's something serious going on. And when you get Poindexter, you get an admiral. It's not a lieutenant colonel. I did promise some people I was with last weekend that I would pull out of my files, it was practically on the top burner, a couple of articles to update on AIDS before I get back or get too far into Contragate, because there's a lot of other things that get pushed aside, and the AIDS articles are important. One was sent to me by a listener of World Watchers from the Alameda County newspaper, the Daily Review, Wednesday, February the 17th. It's titled, United States is Storing Vaccines for Military. The United States military is stockpiling vaccines and drugs to be used to protect the armed forces, not civilians, during biological war. The military's research in the field, including search for an anti-AIDS drug, is unclassified, but their treatments do find non-military uses. Colonel David L. Huxoll, commander of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, said, we just don't have budgets big enough to lay down a sizable stockpile of this material. The Institute has developed 16 vaccines and drugs against natural toxins or viruses. The Institute routinely tests the effectiveness of new drugs and a variety of these viruses at the National Institute of Health. The Institute last year began checking on drugs that against the virus that causes AIDS or acquired immune deficiency syndrome. So you could get immunized if you're in the military against certain viruses that in turn would trigger off AIDS. But if you're not in the military, we don't have enough to go around. When Ronald Reagan became president, he wanted a several trillion dollars weapons improvement. He wants $4 to $5 billion for two new ships. Each one is $4 to $5 billion. But they don't have enough money to immunize you for these viruses that in turn would start your AIDS. The article says the military stockpiles are intended for 3 million people, including all the armed forces, reservists, and the National Guard. The Institute at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, has about 500 workers. Its budget last year was $125 million. The faculty is charged with developing defenses against biological weapons. A treaty prohibits biological weapons but permits research for the defense. Now, if they already have a way to start AIDS, they can have the money now to find a way to defend those people against it, and they're focusing on defense against biological weapons. And researchers there do not use genetic engineering or other techniques to produce new virulent organisms. They're not doing that there anymore, even solely to, in turn, develop defense against them. We have enough diseases, they said. They're talking about altering an organism. I'm not going to second guess how somebody could alter that. There's enough bad ones out there, but what they're doing is creating a way to fight viruses, and those specific viruses cause AIDS, and the provision is to save 3 million people, and they will all be National Guard or military, so you better sign up. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal just this past week, March 17th, United States and French scientists seek to end the dispute over the discovery of AIDS. This is a bitter dispute that's been taking place between the National Institute of Health and the Pasteur Institute in Paris, each claiming that they discovered AIDS the same day, practically. And Wall Street Journal describes it as a long, smoldering dispute. Who gets scientific credit and who gets the profit for making this AIDS immunization, if it's possible, once the AIDS is out. Dr. Gallo in the United States said his virus was HTLV-3. Dr. Montagnier's virus is LAV. They're practically identical, and there was speculation in Paris about the royalties. Meantime, separately, the United States Patent Office granted Dr. Gallo from the National Institute of Health here in the United States co-worker Milkolas Popovic, P-O-P-O-V-I-C, they granted them a patent covering their method of mass-producing the virus for research purposes. The method was critical to AIDS research because it afforded scientists a sufficient quantity of virus to study. So the Americans can make as much virus as they want. They got a special grant, and in having it, they hope to kill off the target cells that disappear later, and it's unable to build up a resistance or a cure to AIDS. The whole idea is that these American scientists, and they've been working with the French scientists in Zaire, where there are a lot of AIDS, the Americans now have permission and a patent to mass produce the virus that's critical to AIDS and then to study it. But if they mass produce it, there's always a chance that it escapes or gets delivered somewhere, because can they keep control of everybody who handles the AIDS that they're going to mass produce? Another article, this is the Houston Post, February 15th. Second AIDS virus strain found by researchers. Old blood tests that people were given can't detect the new bug. They can keep making a new virus now until kingdom come or till everybody is gone. This is out of Tokyo. A new strain of the virus that caused the killer disease AIDS has been found in some patients in Africa and Europe. At a conference in Japan, Dr. Francois Bar-Sinoussi of the Pasteur Institute said researchers must formulate a new blood test to detect a new strain. They had the LAV1, and now they have the LAV2. The new strain was enveloped in a different type of protein than the original virus, called LAV-1 or HTLV-3. The human body forms a different type of antibody against LAV2, which makes detection by conventional tests more difficult. So now you have to go into new tests and new ways to detect AIDS, because the one test doesn't work for the new virus, and let's count how many viruses. Mortzel said the reason they started numbering World War I and World War II was that there would be other wars to follow, and they may as well give them a number. And sure enough, this year there are articles that they're making weapons for World War IV, and that World War III is a fait accompli. The Sanford Observer, this copy was sent to me by a listener of World Watchers, and I'm part of the Stanford alumni, so I get my paper also. They have an article, High-Tech Center for Genetic Medicine. Private sources, no government, commit $86.6 million. They're building a molecular and genetic medicine hospital run by Dr. Paul Berg, the Nobel Prize-winning biochemist, and it's going to study genetic medicine, and a big hunk of the money comes from the Hughes Medical Institute Unit in Molecular and Genetic Medicine. The Hughes Institute is giving Stanford $17.8 million. Now, they say private sources commit this money, and $17 million comes from Hughes. Hughes was all military money. It was Hughes aircraft. It's all government. It's not private. These people make money from weapons, just as Hewlett-Packard funds Stanford. Each one gives like $40 million or $50 million this past year. They gave that. That's government money. One was former Deputy Secretary of Defense. It comes out of government contracts. How can you say it's private sources that are building this hospital for genetic medicine, molecular and genetic medicine? With that kind of money, with $86.6 million, and if you didn't have the right mind, you could really kill almost everybody on planet Earth, except the 3 million that will be immunized if they're in the military, and they've already said that's what they're going to do. Now, there was a long article in the San Jose Mercury, March the 8th, last Sunday, called Richard Secord, General Secord, led a secret counterterrorism unit. And I'm sure many of you have seen it. I'm sure it was, or I hope it was, syndicated in other newspapers, but when it just says San Jose Mercury, I'm not sure that you're getting it. And the important thing about General Secord, who comes out of Stanford Technology, which was TCI, and I refreshed you on it last week, and we'll talk about it quite often. TCI set up with President Otto von Bolschwing, Hitler's Gestapo, SS, and RCIA agent. Secord worked in the Air Force and met and worked with Oliver North and William Colby and Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins and General Singlaub. And then in 1983, he retired and went to work, according to this article, after he left the Air Force, he went to work as a member of the Defense Intelligence Agency. The Mercury says the idea for a special task force, and remember, North was supposed to set this all up alone. He just fell right into what was built. The idea for a task force developed with an informal discussion by administration officials in 1982-83. President Reagan approved the arrangement April 3, 1984, and signed a National Security Decision Directive directed by Oliver North. One essential part of the directive authorized the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon version of the CIA, to employ intelligence agents to collect information about terrorism. Unlike the CIA, the DIA is not required to report certain sensitive operations to Congress. And this is one of the things that I've hammered away, how these authors go around talking about the CIA, Philip Agee and John Stockwell and so forth, or Ralph Magee, and it is the DIA that took the power away from the CIA, just as I cited from this new book on the CIA, how national security took from the CIA. This story says, according to former associates, Secord, a fighter pilot and veteran air commando, led the anti-terrorist task force as one of a small group of government employees and consultants in Middle East, Southeast Asia, because he and those others were absolutely trustworthy, low-profile people who won't talk. Secord retired the year before in 1983 and was eager for a new counterterrorism assignment. According to Pentagon associates, a Secord loyalist who asked not to be identified. The Tower Commission report offers evidence to support the account, as do interviews with Secord's former Pentagon colleagues. The report revealed for the first time that Secord and North and North's boss, Admiral Poindexter, considered a commando raid in Lebanon. Now, the important thing is that when Secord left the Air Force in 1983, he became part of the Defense Intelligence Agency and was taken on by them in a non-salaried position, so it was on the books financially. But for all purposes, the other biographies of Secord said that when he left the Air Force, he joined Albert Hakim, which he did, at Stanford Technology. So what Otto von Bolschwing and Emmanuel Senecas and John Paul Getty's operation was in setting this organization up, and the attorney was Simon Rifkin, who set the TCI up in the first place. The whole purpose was that these guys were a front, an operational front. They just didn't deliver weapons to the Shah or communication systems for the Defense Department. They took away from the National Security Council's regular operations and became part of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now, the chief of the Defense Intelligence Agency for quite a few years was Daniel Graham, who shares offices with the mysterious Fritz Kramer. And so it's his agency that moves these people, and I knew it was all along. Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, Albert Hakim, and General Singlaub. Singlaub was separate from TCI, but joins them in a lot of other operations and joins them through Western Goals and through Mr. Carl Spitz Chammell's offices in Washington, D.C., and through the Reverend Moon operation. Singlaub joins them at that level. But this article is important because of the use of Secord as a non-salaried group. It says that the ISA was formed. This was an intelligence group that was formed earlier to free the hostages when Jimmy Carter was president in 1980, and that these people were part of the airlift that didn't work, the ill-fated airlift. But then after that, Secord and the others hired 13 of the 30 people, the crew who helped defeat Jimmy Carter by having the airlift not work, and they've been part of the Tehran, Iran-Contragate operations. These are the same people, 13 of the 30. The ISA was supposedly deactivated in 1983. That is the intelligence agency that was set up in 1983, the same year that Secord retired. A year later, the New York Times said that the ISA was providing equipment and personnel to the CIA for covert operations in Central America. After his retirement, Secord remained in a high position to oversee covert activities. He served as a non-salaried member of the Pentagon's Special Operation Policy Advisory Group. So that is part of the Otto von Bolschwing network, where Secord is not salaried, not on the books, but works with Hakim out of Vienna, Virginia, and Los Gatos, California. And what was set up by von Bolschwing and Helena von Damm and the Waffen-SS and the OSS is the operating organism or organization that the president has used. Our time is up now. I wanted to do, of course, a lot more in this hour, but the connection of non-salaried Pentagon people to Stanford Technology, given the background of that organization, is very important to understand how the president set up SOPAG, S-O-B-O-A-G, the Pentagon Special Operation Policy Advisory Group. It's very important to know that they worked with Noel Koch of the Defense Department and that the von Bolschwing network in California that worked with Edwin Wilson and Task Force 157, and I'll be doing more on that. The basis of all the things that we're seeing or realizing now, go back to that research I did of TCI and Stanford Technology and the techniques of setting up pockets inside of pockets to the exclusion of Congress and existing agencies, which was the expertise of Henry Kissinger as soon as Richard Nixon became president. They had to have a few murders along the way, but when those were out of the way, Nixon was in, Haig and Kissinger were in, and Kramer could be on the National Security Council with his son managing events there behind the scenes. My time is up now, and of course I'll continue along these lines with a lot more next week. This is Mae Brussel. I'm behind in my mail. I'll write to you soon. There's too much news to answer letters, but I'll get to it. I promise. Eventually, I always do. Keep well. Thanks again for the articles and books, and I'll be back with you next week.